Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. This year marks the 150th anniversary of Yosemite National Park, one of the most magnificent parks in the country. The 1864 Yosemite Grant Act launched the National Park movement, which continues to this day. This year also marks the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act, a landmark conservation bill. In the book Conservation Refugees, the 100-year conflict between global conservation and native peoples, today's guest, award-winning investigative journalist Mark Dowie, writes about how John Muir, the forefather of the American conservation movement, argued that wilderness should be cleared of all inhabitants and set aside to satisfy the need for recreation and spiritual renewal. It was a sentiment that became national policy with the passage of the 1964 Wilderness Act, which defined wilderness as a place, quote, where man himself is a visitor who does not remain, end quote. Mark Dowie writes, it's no secret that millions of native peoples around the world have been pushed off their land to make room for big oil, big metal, big timber, and big agriculture. But few people realize that the same thing has happened for a much nobler cause, land and wildlife conservation. Mark Dowie is an award-winning investigative journalist and author of Conservation Refugees. He's also a contributing editor of Orion Magazine, editor-at-large of Guernica Magazines, and co-founder and chair of the Marin Media Institute. That's a learning institution for small-scale regional media workers. And Mark Dowie joins us from Point Reyes Station. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Rose.
Nice to have you.
Thank you.
So let's start off by talking about Yosemite, because you begin your book by looking at Yosemite. Today, this year is the 150th anniversary. Unfortunately, Yosemite is dealing with yet another massive wildfire, a 2,600-acre wildfire. You focus on John Muir, and I understand that you had to dig a little bit for John Muir's archives. Can you first tell us that story?
Sure. John Muir was really the key person who inspired the creation of Yosemite. And his archives are held by the University of Pacific up near Stockton, California. And if you just go to those archives, you get a sense of who St. John Muir really was, and the archives are very carefully selected to preserve that sainthood. However, some of the documents from his life and his own archives were removed from there, and they're at the Bancroft in Berkeley, and that's where you get a much more realistic view of who John Muir was and what he thought, and particularly what he thought about Native people, which wasn't very complimentary. And so he wanted all Native people removed from this area that is now Yosemite Park, where they had thrived and very responsibly, incidentally, as from an ecological standpoint, had thrived for thousands of years. And he said, get them out, so that basically weary urbanites from the Bay Area and elsewhere could come and enjoy this magnificent place, and it really is a magnificent place.
Well, can you elaborate on that? What did you learn from the archives? What did he say specifically about Native peoples?
Well, they weren't very complimentary things. He required them as dirty diggers. He said that they were... it was interesting because he actually spent time with some Native people in the Sierras before he became a park activist, and he seemed to like some of them. But the Miwok particularly, and the Awanishi, and the people that were in the park, that it, and the area of land that he really wanted to set aside for a national treasure, he had pretty negative things to say about them, uncomplimentary, that they were dirty. And, you know, the interesting thing about dirt is that Native people around the world dust themselves with local dust because it's one, it's a sunscreen, and two, it's an insecticide. Hmm. And so a lot of people who you see, Native people you see in the wild who look like they're covered with dirt, are actually deliberately dusting their bodies. And that was true of the Awanishi in Yosemite and the Paiutes who were there as well. So, I mean, part of it was just he just didn't understand the tradition. And the thing about Yosemite is that it was a very active farm, if you will, for Native people for thousands of years, but you didn't know that because it wasn't fenced, it wasn't plowed. They would just take seeds and plant them in the wild, and they'd take acorns and plant them in the wild, and pine nuts and plant them in the wild. And so it was a deliberate garden for feeding a significant number of people, but it didn't look that way. It looked wild to somebody who didn't see the people or the hogans that they were living in.
How much interaction did he have with the people?
Well, enough to develop a pretty negative attitude. I mean, he was there. He wandered through the Sierras for years. As I say, he actually worked with some sheep-herding Paiutes the Mono Lake Paiutes. He actually lived and worked with them for a while, and he did have some complimentary things to say about them, but he also had a lot of negative things to say about them.
Well, talk a little bit more about the history of Yosemite, because the museum in Yosemite National Park really doesn't focus on this at all. I mean, you don't really learn anything about the Native people. In fact, they have this one interactive exhibit that shows this little girl, you push a button, and she kind of tells a story, and she says, when the white people came, they gave Mommy and Daddy a job. But they don't really tell you the story of Native people at all in the Yosemite Museum.
They were brought into management of the park when the park was formed. Some actually were allowed to live inside the park, but in a cabin environment that was created out of sight of visitors. And they were the workers. The Miwok were workers in the park for a long, long time, and the Awanishi. But slowly but surely, the Park Service replaced them with Caucasian workers, and I think the last Native actually left the park, I've forgotten the exact date, it's in my book, around 1968, 1970, I don't remember, and there was a huge flood after that that washed out a large part of the valley, and a lot of Native people thought that was some kind of Native natural retribution for their expulsion, but so it was gradual, the expulsion, but of people from the park. But in terms of living in the park the way they had originally lived, that stopped immediately on the formation of the park. And that has continued through the development of the entire American National Park system. There are six or seven other parks that followed the example of Yosemite and removed Native people to create a park.
We'll talk about that in a minute, but where did the Native people go when they left Yosemite?
Some of them live quite close by. They live in the towns outside the park and in the areas, and their descendants live there. I interviewed several of them to do this book, and they have some pretty interesting stories to tell. And I actually found one historian up at Yosemite who knew the true and full story of the eviction of Native people to create the park. That's not the official story of Yosemite, as I think you found yourself, but he told me the story as best as he recollected, and gave me other historians who knew the story much better than the official National Park story. That is also true in Zion and Yellowstone and the other parks that were created after Yosemite, where Native people had to be removed to create the park. It's they have revised the history. They've, like every big institution, they've created a self-generated mythology about what they are and how they started and how noble their cause is. But there are a lot of Native people living quite close who don't think it's so noble.
We have a listener who just wrote in saying, can you please cite the documents you're quoting from? And more generally, what else did Muir say about Native Americans?
No, I I wrote this book like 5 or 6 years ago. All of the documents are in the footnotes of the book. I can't do that over the air. I'd bore the heck out of your listeners to do that. But I can cite the documents if that person wants to call me. I can point them to them, and they're all footnoted in my book.
Can you tell us anything more about what Muir said about Native Americans?
Again, that the details and the actual quotes of what he said are in the book. I wrote this book like 5 or 6 years ago, and I can't remember the direct quotes, but they're there. I can characterize them as negative, but I I'm looking for them right now, and I can't even find them. But
and the archives, are they available for the public to see? The archives that you found?
Oh yeah, there are two sets of archives. There are the hagiographic archives, the saintly archives, which are at University Pacific, and then there's a separate mural archive at the Bancroft in Berkeley.
Okay, well, thanks for the email, Greg. Are any of these online? Do you know? Can we link to them?
They weren't when I did this,
okay.
But they may be. I frankly doubt it. I mean, archives, you know, particularly personal archives of famous people like this, do not get scanned up onto the internet as fast as they probably should be. So I can't say I know for sure, but certainly when I did my research, which started about 10 years ago, and it took me 4 years to do this book, when I started doing it, none of this was online, no.
Mm. Well, as we're celebrating the 150th anniversary of Yosemite National Park, what are your thoughts about the media coverage that this has received, and have you seen any of this history in your reading?
No, I haven't seen any accurate history of Yosemite in the celebration of the thing, of the 150th anniversary, and I don't expect to. I don't think there are many people who work in the Park Service, frankly, who know the history very well. There are historians, and I did find one of them. I blank in his name. He's footnoted in my book, who did know the history more accurately. And to them, to the Park Service, it's kind of a revisionist history. I mean, I think a lot of them don't believe it themselves. It is kind of embarrassing. I mean, this park was being developed during a period of time in California history when the governor of the state was saying that it should be state policy to eliminate all Native people in California.
Mm-hmm.
That was a matter of state policy. So the Mariposa Battalion, which was the battalion that went into Yosemite and actually either routed or killed the people that would refuse to leave the park, where they were an extension of a long-standing policy, state policy, to remove Natives from the state, all Natives, eliminate them. The governor, Peter Burnett, the first governor of the state, that was state policy. So that was a time in national history when racism was pretty severe. You're talking about turn of the century stuff. I mean, the Sierra Club was endorsing policies in the national parks that were making them whites only parks. Whites only. So, I mean, we are shocked by that now, but then it was kind of de rigueur to be that racist about Native people and about people of color.
I'm speaking with Mark Dowie, an award-winning investigative journalist and author of the book Conservation Refugees, The 100-Year Conflict Between Global Conservation and Native Peoples. And we're talking with Mark today about the history of the conservation movement and Native peoples. We'll also talk about just how things have changed so much over the years. I mean, today you've got Indigenous people on the front lines of movements against fracking, against development, against Keystone, for example. So if you have any questions for Mark about this history, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. If you work for the National Park System, what are your thoughts about what he's saying about the history of specifically Yosemite? We'll talk about some other parks. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So, Mark, talk a little bit about, you were mentioning some other national parks and how they use the same model as Yosemite.
Well, there were six or seven tribes in the West that either lived in or used the resources and facilities of what is now Yellowstone Park. And they were systematically routed from the park by the army, and there was one hideous day in that history when 300 Shoshone were all killed in one, because they resisted removal, they were killed in one attack on their settlement. And some of the tribes were migrant tribes who went through that area either to hunt or fish in certain seasons, or live there in the summer, but then migrate out in the winter. So, but it was a very, very active part of the life of Native people in the Rocky Mountains, in the Northern Rockies. And when they formed the park, they said They describe the native people as afraid of the park and afraid of the femorals and the geysers that were there, which couldn't be more less true. I mean, they cooked over the geysers and they bathed in the water, the warm water of the geysers. So that was part of the reason that they went there, which is, of course, part of the reason why tourists go there now to see the geysers erupting on schedule. So they're then you move to Zuni, there were six or seven other parks that were developed over the years that followed where native people were removed. And, of course, that caught on globally and became a global model, an international model for creating, preserving wilderness and creating protected areas and national parks. And the result was the eviction of millions of people around the world over the century that followed the creation of Yellowstone, of Yosemite and Yellowstone. People do refer to this now. People who are writing the history of that I wrote, or versions of the history, they refer to this as the Yosemite model of conservation.
What struck you about the interviews that you did? I just, when you said that you were interviewing people, it reminded me of Julia Parker. Are you familiar with her?
Mm-hmm.
She often is inside the museum at Yosemite weaving baskets and talking a little bit about the history. She's a Coast Miwok Kashaya Pomo basket weaver.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because there's some sort of internecine competition going on, or there was when I was doing my book, between the different tribes that were there. There were really three tribes or bands of Native people that used the park, either lived there or migrated there. So there were the Lake Mono Paiutes, the Miwok, and the Awanishi. These were all separately, and the Awanishi were actually kind of a blend. It's ethnography of their history, but so there were three. And every time I've said anything or written anything, I get a note, and you probably will before the show is over, get a note from one member of those tribes saying that my history or the history that the other tribal people are saying is inaccurate. We were there first. There were more of our people there than the other people, and that kind of stuff. I try to avoid that because that all of that argument or that kind of detail, because it's when it's internecine and it's relevant to the fact that conservationists and the conservation impulse push them all out of the park eventually. So, it's a sad story. Of course, the whole story of Native people in America is a sad story.
Let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Charlie in Berkeley. Hi, Charlie. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm sorry that if I'm talking about something that has already been discussed. I just got an email on this topic from a friend who mentioned your show was on, and I think it's fascinating. I work with Native tribes in the Yosemite area.
Oh.
And in fact, my job is to try to encourage the participation of the regional tribes in the of the gateway communities in the activities that are happening around the national park. I work with a group called Yosemite Gateway Partners. And I want to thank Mr. Dowie. This is very much my experience. I have a difficult time trying to get the Native tribes to come back and to identify and participate in it. And I've often wondered what the root issue of that difficulty in engaging the tribes around and identifying sort of with what the rest of us identify with the national park and this wonderful iconic place of conservation and so forth. But my question really quickly is, I joined late in the call, but I'm just wondering, is the experience of Native people in national parks that much different from their experience throughout the rest of the lands and the rest of the treaty lands that they were chased off of and taken away from throughout the country?
And Charlie, thanks for the question. Before we get to it, I wanted to ask you a question. Is Charlie still there?
Sure.
Yeah, what do you hear from the Native people when you talk to them about getting involved in the parks?
Well, part of the challenge is, as Mr. Dowie said, that first of all, there's conflicting claims of whose ancestors were there. I work with the Western Mono people, and even there was a a difficult history, let's say, between, you know, Chief Tenaya, who was raised in one group but then went back to another group. So I think part of the challenge is it's difficult. You know, no one group 100% identify with it, and yet many groups claim some identity with it. So it's a challenge just to get a group that really feels that this is clearly part of their history, although they all feel it's a little bit a part of their history. So, you know, that's one of the challenges, and there are other challenges in the relationship to the federal government and the National Park Service. I think to some degree that makes it more difficult. There are currently, I think, 7 tribes around the Yosemite area that have federal recognition, let's say, status with and relationship to the to Yosemite National Park, and those tribes participate in top-level consultation. But then trying to get them to participate in other things, it often is a challenge.
All right. Well, thanks for calling in. So, Mark, Charlie wants to know, what's the difference between this land and the rest of the land that was taken?
Well, I mean, the history of post-Columbian America is a history of eviction. And so this, in a way, his question is very, very good and very pointed, because this was an extension of, you know, a couple of centuries of massive eviction that was taking place all over North America, both the Americas, really. If you look far enough back, it's a European-driven eviction of Native people, and this was an extension of that. I mean, there were not very many people who were very uncomfortable at the time about removing those tribes from Yosemite to create the park. There wasn't a strong resistance to it amongst the non-Native community. In fact, the Natives were pretty powerless to do anything about it, and particularly in the face of those militias, the battalions, heavily armed. Every sheriff in the region had a battalion at his disposal that could move in with heavy arms and wipe out a community of Native people in a heartbeat, and they did. So they were intimidated, as they were all along. And you know, in other parts of the country, there was some pretty strong Native resistance to this kind of genocidal behavior. But there really wasn't there. The tribes that Charlie describes in that region historically were pretty peaceful people, and really wanted to try to get along with the new settlers in the area, despite the battalion.
Do you know what are the politics behind telling some of this history at Yosemite, especially in the museum, where you have people from all over the world visiting the museum, and yet what you see are big baskets, pretty clothes. Again, Julia Parker is weaving, but she's not saying anything, and it's a little odd because people are taking photos of her, but she's not saying anything.
Well, I don't know her well enough to know whether or not she knows the whole story. It's certainly accessible. I mean, she could find it, and maybe she's got a job, and part of her job is to keep the history to herself. And this is an embarrassing part of National Park history. I mean, this is not something they're going to go out and tout to the world. That they stole a lot of land to create this park system in America.
Well, hold that thought, Mark. We're going to take a quick break. We're speaking today with Mark Dowie, an award-winning investigative journalist and author of the book Conservation Refugees, The 100-Year Conflict Between Global Conservation and Native Peoples. This year marks the 150th anniversary of Yosemite National Park and the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act. It's your call. We'll be back after this.
Lots of ways to take part in today's conversation on Your Call, on the phone, or by sending an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or by going to the website yourcallradio.org and leaving your message. The phone number to join is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. Coming up at 11, the BBC's World Have Your Say, here on local public radio. Broadcast of Your Call is made possible by KALW listeners and supporters, including Mia Stageberg of San Francisco and Imogene Ayers of El Sobrante.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about the skills needed for success in the digital age. The Department of Labor predicts that there will be 1.2 million new computer science-related jobs by 2022, but fewer computer science majors are graduating today compared to the 80s. So we will talk about this and talk about whether coding is the key to securing a good-paying job, and if so, how can we make it accessible to everyone? That's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are speaking with Mark Dowie. He's an award-winning journalist and author of Conservation Refugees, The 100-Year Conflict Between Global Conservation and Native Peoples. And he writes about the history between the conservation movement and Native peoples. We'll also talk about Indigenous people who are now on the front lines of movements against fracking, development, oil pipelines like Keystone. There's the group Idle No More. 350.org has so many Indigenous groups involved with that, with them. And so if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions for Mark about the history of the conservation movement, if you work in the conservation movement, we'd love to hear from you. And if you're part of a tribe and you know about this history and want to talk about Indigenous people who are now on the front lines of these movements, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave us a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And thanks again, Charlie, for calling. Let's go next to Alicia in Berkeley.
If you need help.
Alicia? Oh, we dropped Alicia. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. So, Mark, you talk about this Yosemite model. Can you also talk about some success stories around the world where conservationists actually worked with Indigenous peoples to create national parks, for example?
Yeah. I want to say before I do that, I want to say that I regard this as a good guy versus good guy story. And I have to say that because that's kind of unusual for me. Investigative reporters are usually looking for people with black hats and people with white hats and comparing them to each other. This is a white hat versus white hat story. Both these institutions or movements, if you will, care deeply about the planet. They're capable of preserving more biological diversity together than any other two institutions. They have been at odds, sometimes violently. But that's usually due to, like, conflicting views of nature, radically different definitions of wilderness, and a really profound misunderstanding of each other's perspectives on science and culture. And all of this is improving. All of this is changing as they're starting to speak to each other now in respectable ways, which they didn't for 100 years. And Native people regarded conservation as you said earlier, one of the enemies, one of their major enemies, along with all of the extractive industries that were going in and fouling up their land to get resources, they had started to include conservationists as the enemy, and that's changing. And it's changing because I think conservationists are starting to realize that traditional ecological knowledge, which is the knowledge that is possessed by Native people, it's not in textbooks because they don't read and write. It's passed on from generation to generation. But anthropologists and biologists who've gone into Native communities and with the purpose of studying traditional ecological knowledge realize that it's actually very sophisticated. It's actually not very different than Western science and Western biological science. And that together, they create a stronger force than either one. In fact, one Native people person describes traditional ecological knowledge as strong like two people. That's a direct quote. And now the large conservation organizations that are very global and large all over the world are starting now to form what they call, they have different names, they call them conservation areas, community conservation areas, CCAs. They also call them biocultural heritage sites, community reserves, locally managed marine areas. They have different names, but they all share a common realization that the Native people that are there and that the reason why these areas that are isolated or set aside for protected areas are do have high biological diversity because the native people that have been living there for hundreds or thousands of years are good stewards, and they understand and value biological and biocultural diversity because it affects their food system, right? They know that. And so they then turn to the conservationists who come in and say, we have to set this aside, move out. They say, don't move us out. We know how to manage it. And I think the conservationists are starting to understand that now and appreciate it and are cooperating with Native people around the world in creating these new conservation areas, these new protected areas called community conservation areas and other names.
Mark Dowie is author of Conservation Refugees, The 100-Year Conflict Between Global Conservation and Native Peoples. And let's hear from Rich in San Francisco. Hi, Rich.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Rose. I'm just wondering if the author is aware that in some national parks, such as I think of the Little Bighorn Battlefield Monument, Native Americans actually run key operations in the park. I mean, I think generally speaking that any of us who are relatively familiar with American history, we all know that white people had a different view of people of color in the 1860s, not just Native Americans, but blacks, Chinese, you know, whoever it may have been. And perhaps this did include, you know, the famed conservationist John Muir to a degree, but we also know that the Park Service, you know, just as it may be faulted in this regard, has been talked about on the show of ejecting Native peoples. We also know that, you know, in the early days of Yosemite and, say, Yellowstone, that the Park Service did not have the goals of what we would call maybe ecosystem management today, something that we take for granted is taking place in parks today. But things change. Policies change. People change. And I'm just wondering if it's, you know, if it's fair to indict the Park Service of today based on history and different cultural attitudes from the past. Certainly it's an important story to tell. I don't think it's that new of a story. I think we've known these things since the 80s and early 90s, particularly those of us that work in conservation. And so I'm wondering if in the book the author talks about what the Park Service is doing today, you know, what I believe you leaned towards it a moment ago, Rose, what success stories are out there of working with Native peoples, particularly in regards perhaps to cultural preservation. I think that there's many national parks in Hawaii, for example, that provide a very good example of that. So, you know, I'm just wondering if beyond indicting the Park Service for this history, which may be fair, if the author talks about what the Park Service is doing today.
Yeah, good question, Rich. You know, I don't indict the current National Park Service for what they did 100 or 150 years ago. I'm writing a history here, and I don't think that there are any people in the National Park Service today who even come close to the racial attitudes that you described that we saw in the 19th and early 20th century. So, I agree that there's some national park leaders, and you know most of the parks are fairly autonomous. Their supervisors have a lot of local autonomy, and some of the supervisors are very progressive, and as you say, have brought Native people back into management. In fact, part of Death Valley National Monument has been given back to the Native people that originally occupied it, and that's happening in other small parts of national parks around the country. So that is true. So I don't indict the National Park Service for anything that they're doing today except not recognizing their own history.
Hmm. Well, what do you think would be gained from including this history, for example, in the Yosemite Museum? Because right now it's glaringly missing.
Well, you know, you don't want to create a negative history of your own institution by flashing it up on the wall. But I think for historians, to get an accurate sense of what happened in the early days of these parks, though the material that I dug up should be available somewhere on site, so that you know there's a filing cabinet that you go to and that you can read the history of the Mariposa Battalion, right, and the role that they played in clearing Yosemite for the Park Service, and you know, obviously you don't want to put that up on the wall. I mean, it's horrible. I mean, or, you know, the massacre of the Shoshone in Yellowstone, you don't want to put that up on the wall. It shouldn't be part of your display, but it should be available to anybody who's doing historical research, we shouldn't have to use investigative techniques to dig this stuff up. Hmm. It should be available.
What else would you say in relation to what Rich brought up about the relationship today between Native peoples and conservationists working together to create, whatever the case, a national park, open space, working on movements like, you know, Keystone, for example, fracking. I mean, there's so many incredible movements happening today.
Well, I think contemporary conservation, at least the people, conservationists, people working at the field level, not in the big headquarters in Washington, those are just big money-raising operations, and I don't think that the leadership that is there, whose mandate is to raise money to support the whole operation, I don't think they really understand yet the value of working side-by-side with Native people. But the people in the field clearly do, and so the activists, the people, you cite 350.org, Bill McKibben's people who work in the field are working side by side with natives in Canada and the United States who are being impacted by all of the things that the 350.org are aimed at. So it just makes sense to bring them into the movement, to work side by side with them, stop the exploitation, share the funding with them, and that is happening. And I think that if the people who work in the field now in global conservation rise to the leadership of the big international NGOs that are really driving global conservation, if they do, then I think my book will be irrelevant because the problem will disappear, right? And I think actually there are signs that that is happening, except for the fact that the most powerful people in conservation are the money raisers, the people who are out talking up conservation in very general terms, creating romantic images of wilderness, and raising huge amounts of money to preserve it. And I don't fault them for doing that, except for the fact that they're ignoring the fact that that there are a lot of Native people living in those and thriving in those areas.
Well, they
should be allowed to stay.
And also, do you think part of the problem is that they get all of the media attention, whereas there are a lot of local organizations around the world doing fantastic work on a shoestring budget,
yes,
and yet we don't know most of them?
Sure.
Right?
Yes. That is true. Groups like Conservation International and the Nature Conservancy and the World Wildlife Fund and the Wildlife Conservation Society, the African Wildlife, they have incredible media access because they have the resources to run and manage huge media relations departments. I mean, the media relations department of any one of those groups is bigger than any grassroots environmental or conservation group in the world. They're huge.
We're speaking with Mark Dowie, author of Conservation Refugees, The 100-Year Conflict Between Global Conservation and Native Peoples. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We have an email from Susan who wants to know if you are aware of Native American communities who did this annual walk by foot from Yosemite Valley all the way to Mono Lake. They did this 15 years ago, she writes, when she worked there. Mothers with babies and elders participate. She's wondering if they still do that. Do you know?
I heard about it. It is they are making the annual migratory trek that the Mono Lake Paiutes used to make when Yosemite was part of their settlement. They would leave there in the winter because the winter was very intense, and they would migrate back. Some of them actually came down to the coast. Some of them went back up into the Mono Lake area, which was a little more temperate. And I knew that was happening. I do not know whether it's still happening, but I'm sure that's easy to find out.
Okay, and also Susan recommends a book by Deborah Villoma about Julia Parker, published by Heyday. It's called Scrape the Willow Until It Sings, The Words and Work of Basket Maker Julia Parker. Thank you for that. We'll put that link on our website.
Yeah, that is a good book.
And let's go to Diane in Marin County. Hi, Diane. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Hey, thank you so much for your book and this information. I actually, of course, I know about the genocide of the Native Americans, but I had no idea about the parks. But what I called about was to voice respectfully but vehemently disagree with your comment that this shouldn't be put up on the wall in the Yosemite Park Museum or Visitor Center or other visitor centers. I don't think it should be put up in a gory way that's scary to children and families or anything like that, but I think we should absolutely be honest and include, you know, a section or an area where we do tell what happened. I think that's a glaring omission in many histories and museums that we see, that and that sort of topic. So I think we should be honest and true and historical. And I just think a balanced view is much better for all the American people to know about. We shouldn't let this be forgotten and only available for historians to dig up in archives.
Well, the superintendent of Yosemite National Park's name is Don Neubacher, and I'm sure he'd love to get a letter from you to that effect. Having seen some of the photographs and the post conflict remains of some of the people that were slaughtered in this thing, I just think it's a little heavy. And that's what I mean, keep off the wall. I don't say glorify the creation of the park and lie about the price that Native people paid to create these parks. I don't mean that. I just think you've got to be a little bit careful. Remember, these exhibit rooms are largely educational, and most of the people who go there, or half the people who go there, are children. Mm. And I would say I agree with you, Diane, but I would be selective about what I put up on the wall. I've seen some of the original photos, and believe me, you don't want to put them up on the wall anywhere.
All right. Well, thank you for calling, Diane. We have an email from Alina who writes, do you see any analogies between the situation you are describing and efforts to remove the Drake's Bay oyster farm that had existed for decades before the establishment of the Point Reyes National Seashore?
No, I don't consider the removal of Drake's Bay oyster farm identical or similar to, and remember, this was where they are, was Miwok country, and the Miwoks, before the park was formed, the Miwoks were murdered by settlers coming right in here to the Point Reyes National area. So it's no exception. And the Miwoks did cultivate oysters where the oyster farm exists today. So we know that that it's always been a good place to cultivate oysters. They may not have cultivated them, but they farmed them. I think that the farm that is there now was cultivating them. The farm, I think, goes out this week. But I don't consider that similar. It's not something that I think the Park Service should be proud of, evicting that oyster farm. It's one of 500 business concessions inside the national park, and it's growing food, and it has a very, very minor, possibly even positive ecological footprint. If you're going to control the concessions and the things inside national parks that have an impact on the environment or on conservation, start with the paved roads, the parking lots, the big lodges, the cruise ships, the spas, the golf courses, the jet skis, the stuff that really, really, really do cause a serious ecological problem for the areas, which the oyster farm really never did. And the people who wanted to push it out tried very hard to make a case that it was an ecologically negative force in the park, and they lost that battle and finally won it on legal history, really.
We're getting quite a few emails about John Muir still, Mark. A lot of people want to know where else they can read about his views on Native Americans.
Well, as I said, his correspondence that is in the Bancroft, start with the first chapter, the first full chapter of my book, which is entitled Miwok, and it is there, and there are a lot of footnotes there that will steer people to John Muir. Frederick Turner wrote a very good history of John Muir that And as I said, he missed the Bancroft, and he's very embarrassed about it. He's a friend of mine, and he missed the Bancroft, and got most of what he got from the archives at the official Muir archives, which are at the University of Pacific. And I mean, if you really, really are interested in the real John Muir, who incidentally owned a slave, and was a complex character, and he has been romanticized. I mean, every time I say anything negative about him, I hear from a lot of my friends who work for the Sierra Club and elsewhere, who have sanctified John Muir in their work and in their lives. But you know, like anybody, he is a complex and not totally admirable figure. So if they go to the Bancroft Library, which is the public library at the University of California, and ask for the correspondence and journals of John Muir, they'll find what I'm talking about.
Okay, and again, earlier Mark said that the information is probably not online, so you'd have to actually go there.
Yeah.
And the book, again, is Conservation Refugees, the 100-Year Conflict Between Global Conservation and Native Peoples. Mark, you've done a lot of traveling. You've spoken to a lot of indigenous people. There was a great cover story on National Geographic, I'm pretty sure it was late last year, called Rainforest Warriors, How Indigenous Tribes Protect the Amazon. I mean, we're seeing so many more stories about this nowadays. I mean, so, it's nothing new, but it's getting, you know, front page attention on the National Geographic. What else really strikes you about how indigenous tribes are really on the front lines of various movements around the globe?
Well, it's true, but if you go far enough back to why and look at why the indigenous tribes in the Amazon are protecting the Amazon, they're not protecting the Amazon in the interest of conservation, per se, the kind of conservation that we identify with conservation. They're protecting the Amazon in their own interest, the interest of food security. And what's interesting and what modern conservationists are starting to discover is that protecting the environment and biological diversity for the sake of food security is really the same as protecting it for the sake of aesthetic values and protection of endangered species, wildlife species, etc. It comes basically to the same thing. And whether you're protecting an area or protecting biological diversity in the interest of food security or in the interest of endangered species, you're really doing the same thing. And so you might as well work together. And so now Native people who are seeking public attention are seeking it through the channel of traditional conservation, saying, look, we're protecting the species because we're protecting the foliage in the Amazon. We don't want the Amazon cut down. Mm-hmm. And we're doing that. So give us credit. And put us on the cover of National Geographic. We're good people. We're doing the right thing. And please don't push us off our land, because if you do, big timber is going to come in and cut it all down. Mm.
This was from the December 22nd, 2013 issue, and you can find it online. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on other movements? I mean, we've done so many shows. We continue to do shows about all of these issues. These are some of the most critical issues of our time. Programs on Keystone, on fracking, worldwide protest against Monsanto. I mean, there's just so much. What are your thoughts on these groups, like specifically Idle No More?
I think that any group like that, like 350 and Idle No More, and that have realized that the best and most effective way to fight against the irresponsible extractive industries is to form an alliance with Native people. Mm-hmm. And I think that Native people have realized the same thing, that the best way for them to protect their homelands and their lifeways and their food security is to form an alliance with global conservation. So it is happening. And the race is on, really, between the extractive industries and the people who want to save and cultivate an ecologically sound planet.
And I should say, Idle No More is an indigenous rights group that originated in Canada. And a lot of women actually started this. Now it's a huge, massive group, but it originated among the Aboriginal peoples in Canada.
Yes, Idle No More. It is a group, and you know, they've been fighting the Athabasca tar sands long before we ever heard about them.
Mm. Yeah. So, as someone who has followed this for a long time and looks at it through an historical lens, this is kind of a big question because there's so many issues at stake here. But where do you see this going now that so many indigenous groups are involved in these movements?
Well.
As
background to my answer, I have to say that the indigenous movement, the global indigenous movement, is one of the most amazing of social movements in the history of the world. I mean, you're talking about 4,500 different cultures speaking 4,500 different languages with none of the technology that we have available to us, none of the financial resources that we have available to us, have been able to get the entire world and the United Nations and the major nations of the world to listen to their message and say, you have to include us in this process of saving the planet. Mm-hmm. We're part of it. We're the original stewards. We're the first stewards of the land that you are now trying to preserve under the rubric of conservation. You have to include us. And I think that message is finally getting through to conservation leadership.
Mark Dowie is an award-winning investigative journalist and author of Conservation Refugees, the 100-Year Conflict Between Global Conservation and Native Peoples. Mark, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome, Rose.
Thank you, and thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Is coding the new literacy? On the next Your Call, we're talking about what skills are necessary for success in the digital age. The Department of Labor predicts that there will be 1 million new computer science-related jobs by 2022, but fewer computer science majors are graduating today compared to the 80s. Is coding the key to securing a good-paying job? If so, how can we make it accessible to all? And how are organizations reaching out to underserved communities? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan, Ali Budner, and Becca Hoekstra produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.